So in this class, let us study about statistical inference. In slide 1, you are seeing the introduction to statistical inference in pharmaceutical sciences. Before I take up whatever is there in slide 2, you see statistical inference in pharmaceutical sciences. I am trying to introduce the topic to you by means of an imaginary example. Before I even start the example, let me tell you what statistical inference is. Statistics is all about taking decisions. We have to take decisions. As experimenters, we are always doing research and we are doing experiments. We are trying to see whether drug A is better than drug B. Whether drug A, drug B, drug C, which is the best? Which is having the lowest price? Which is having the most cost effectiveness? Which treatment? Sometimes we take decisions between two drugs. Sometimes we take decisions between two varieties of treatments. Each treatment may be having so many steps, A plus B plus C plus D. So which treatment is cost effective? Which treatment is more effective? Like this, there are so many types of which design is more effective, decisions that we have to take. And in this decision taking process, we use certain statistical tools. One is the testing of hypothesis and another is the estimation. Estimation is also a related topic. Estimation consists of making an interval estimate or a point estimate and determining the confidence intervals. What is a point estimate? Suppose I ask you, what percentage of marks are you expecting in your first semester? Suppose you answer, 80%, madam. So that's a point estimate. Suppose I tell you, no, you shouldn't say that because you will not be exactly getting 80%. It is better and safe to quote an interval rather than a point. Then you are likely to say, madam, I am likely to get between 75 to 85. So how you are determining this 75 to 85? If 80 is the mean you are expecting, if 5 is the standard deviation you are expecting, based on your experience of your previous marks, you know that your mean is 80, your standard deviation is 5. So then you say that you are taking 1 sigma limits, 75 to 85. So that is a confidence interval. Suppose you decide to be safe, play safe and take a higher confidence interval, 70 to 890. So you are taking 2 sigma limits. Suppose you decide to play even safer and you tell 65 to 95, you are taking 3 sigma limits. So how confident of your are of your result, of your preparation, what is your mean, what is your standard deviation will determine the confidence interval that you are giving. So taking this 1 sigma limit is one method. But the exact way in which the confidence interval is calculated is like this. Mean plus or minus 1.96 standard error for 95% confidence limits. So what is the standard error? Sigma by square root n, as you already know. 1.96 into sigma by square root n is the 95% confidence limit. So what do? Because 80 is the mean you are expecting. Depending upon the where sample size is n, where sigma is standard deviation, you take 80 plus or minus 1.96 sigma by square root n is the 95% confident limit. 80 plus or minus 2.58 into sigma by square root n is the 99% confidence limits. So this is one way in the decision making process. So, where do you use this concept of confidence intervals in pharmaceutical sciences? Suppose tomorrow you are appointed as an executive in a pharmaceutical company and your managing director gives you the job of determining the shelf life of a product. You are introducing a product and you are determining the shelf life of a product. You have to put the expiry date on the product. So, confidence intervals becomes useful to you there. So, what do you do? You put up the product for stability studies. Just as you are doing in your practicals now, you take the strip of tablets, you put them in a stability chamber at a particular temperature and humidity. then every week or every month, depending upon whatever is the interval point, you take a sample, you determine its drug content, and you determine if it is a tablet, you determine its hardness, disintegration time, dissolution time, all these things you find out. So you take like that for 5 or 6 months, then utilizing those values, you find out what is the decomposition rate, what is the reaction rate constant, is it K0 or K1. You find out the K1, the rate of decomposition of the drug product. Then that is the mean value, drug content is the mean value that I am talking about. Then what is the drug content? Now you have the pharmacopoeia limits. Pharmacopoeia will tell you if 100 mg is the labeled claim, if the drug content falls below 95, suppose it tells that if the drug content falls below 95 mg, then declare it as expired. So now you find out the amount of drug content. What is the confidence interval? So for the drug content to fall below 95 mg, what is the likelihood? That is, every month you are determining the drug content. At what point it is falling below 95 mg? You can determine it graphically, and also for every drug content you can draw a confidence interval point. I'll explain a little bit elaborately. Suppose at the 5th month, after you have kept for stability studies, at the 5th month you found that the mean is 98 mg, the standard deviation is 2, and the N is 5. Then at that point you determine the confidence intervals as 98 plus or minus 1.96 into 2 by square root of 5. So now you have a confidence interval. 98 mg is a single point, but you have a confidence interval, maybe 96 to 100. So you know that at the end of the 5th month, the drug content is likely to be between 96 to 100. Like that you go on determining at the end of every month. Suppose at some point you will get that the confidence interval is between, say, 91 to 94. Now you know that 91 to 94 is below the limit prescribed by the pharmacopoeial limits. So suppose that comes at the end of 1 year. Now you know that your confidence interval is beneath the required labeled claim at the end of 1 year. So you put 1 year as the shelf life and declare the expiry date has to be after 1 year. So this is the process how you calculate confidence intervals and use them in the stability studies. At this point, how statistics will help you, it is also helping you in the confidence interval calculation further. It depends upon, suppose you are taking 1.96 confidence interval, it is narrow. Suppose you are taking 2.58 into sigma by square root and it is wide. So if you are a person who is likely to take a risk, suppose you want to keep the product on the shelf for a long time, then you can make use of the 2.58 confidence intervals, that is the 99% confidence intervals, that will give you a longer shelf life. But in keeping the longer shelf life, what is the risk you are taking? The risk is that the drug content may, if the lower confidence interval becomes right, suppose, and the drug content is only 89 mg, and at that point one drug inspector comes to the shop, takes that particular tablet, sends it to the drug control laboratory where it is analyzed, and it is declared as NSQ, not of standard quality. What has happened to your reputation? Your reputation suffers, and it will come in the paper, such and such a drug from this company is banned, please don't purchase this. So what does it do to your reputation? It is bad for your reputation. That is the wrong side of it. What about the plus side? The plus side is, this: in this confidence interval, the bottom part is 89. The top part may be 96. So 96 is within your acceptance criteria. So the tablet is kept on the shelf life of all the medical shops. The batch of tablets are kept in the shop of all the medical shops. For a long time it is there, people are purchasing, you are getting a lot of money. You see? So this is how for every decision, there is a plus side, there is a minus side. There is a risk side, there is a safety side. So you determine the confidence intervals, and how much risk do you want to take will depend upon you. upon the quality of the product, upon your management and all this. So what here this confidence intervals calculation thing is doing you is, it is giving you a rational basis to take the decision. Whether you want to play it safe and take the positive side and quickly remove it from the shelf, no matter if you lose some money, but you don't want to lose your reputation. That is the playing safe side. What about the negative side? It is okay. You will take the risk of the drug inspector catching you, but you will keep it on the shelf and so that your company will get some money. So this is the negative side. So the confidence interval is a tool which you are utilizing to take a decision with respect to the expiry date of the drug product. Did you understand? So the confidence interval calculation is very simple. All that you need are mean, standard deviation and sample size. For 95% confidence interval, the formula is x bar plus or minus 1.96 into sigma by square root n. This is the narrower confidence interval. For the calculation of the 99% confidence interval, you utilize x bar plus or minus 2.58 into sigma by square root n. So if you want to play safe, you use the positive side confidence interval. If you want to take a risk, you use the negative side confidence interval. So this is how statistical tool is being utilized in the taking of decision process. So that is the one side. This is the, that is known as estimation. You are estimating a confidence interval. This is known as statistical inference. So this is also a similar thing, but here, what is the word inference meaning? Inference is you are making a conclusion. From a certain data, you are coming to a conclusion. So this is also known as testing of hypothesis. What is this testing of hypothesis? When a particular information is available to you, first step, information is available. Second step, you form a hypothesis. Third step, you take a decision. So when some information is available to us, we make a hypothesis. What is the hypothesis? Diclofenac is as good as ibuprofen, or there is no difference between diclofenac tablets and ibuprofen tablets as far as their analgesic activity is concerned. That's a hypothesis. Then you take a 50 ibuprofen tablets, you take 50 diclofenac tablets and you administer them to rats, and by rat pyoderma method you find out whether what is the analgesic effect of these two, an anti-inflammatory effect of these two. Then you take all the data, you find their mean, you find their standard deviation, and utilizing the mean, standard deviation and the sample size, you calculate certain test statistics. So by means of these test statistics, you go for the decision. So just as I said, estimation helps you in taking decisions. Inference also helps you in taking decision. This process is known as testing of hypothesis. So this is an essential process which you all have to learn. And once you learn this process, you are going to utilize them extensively in your experimentation and in your research, in your M.Pharm final research and in your PhD research also, the testing process is going to be utilized by you. So this is a tool which helps you in taking the decision. So now let us imagine something as is shown in slide 2. Imagine yourself to be the MD of a pharmaceutical company. Just imagine, leave your imagination, you are the managing director. Don't think it's an easy thing. It is the place where they say the ball ends. So you have to take the decision. The chief of your R&D division comes to you with a proposal. Sir, we developed a most novel formulation of a drug. Please introduce this into the market. Now you imagine, madam, we developed a most novel formulation of a drug. Please introduce this into the market. So the R&D chief is ready with a new formulation and he or she wants to introduce it into the market. Now you have to take a decision, and this decision involves a risk. If you introduce it into the market and if it becomes a hit, you will be happy. Every decision has a positive side and a negative side. So many companies in India are ready. If you don't introduce a new product every year, you are not considered a success. So companies always want to introduce new products, because that's when they grow. New products are welcomed by the society and by the doctors. So your R&D is offering a product. So if you introduce into the market, if it becomes a hit, you will be happy. No problem at all. Profits, reputation. Oh, this company is strong on research. And you have a good thing and you are appreciated. Slide 3. But if it fails, you lose money and you lose prestige as well. Suppose you hesitate to introduce it, fearing failure. Your R&D chief may feel disappointed with you and resign. Then he may go to another company and give it to them. They may introduce it and earn profits. In such a case, you would have lost a valuable opportunity to win profits and people may consider you a coward. So this is the other side of it. If you don't take the decision and if you tell, no, no, Mr. R&D chief, if it is not taken by the doctors, we'll lose money. So I play safe, I don't introduce it into the market. Then some negative things may happen. Suppose you hesitate to introduce it, what may happen? The R&D chief is disappointed with you. What? This man is not ready to take a risk. Not ready to take a calculated risk. So R&D chief may resign. Immediately another company may absorb him. And he may give the product to the new company. The new company may introduce it and they may earn the profits which you should have earned actually. You would have lost a valuable opportunity to win profits and people may consider you a coward. I am just telling you the two sides of a decision. Often in high positions you have to take the decisions. So if you introduce, the positive is you may earn profits, you may get prestige. The negative is you may lose the, you may not get the profits. It may be a failure, you may not get the profits. In addition, that is if you introduce. Suppose if you don't introduce, you see every decision has two sides. Introduce, win is one chance. Introduce, lose is another chance. Then don't introduce, that is the second decision. If you don't introduce, then again, what are the two possibilities? When you don't introduce, okay, the product is actually a poor product. Nobody will take it. And you don't lose any profits or prestige. That is one possibility. What is the other possibility? You don't introduce, the R&D man will go to another company. That company will earn profits and prestige. That is another possibility. So you have two decisions and four possibilities. Slide 4. So life involves taking decisions, and in taking decisions you have to weigh benefits against risks and take a calculated risk. So this is it. There is no decision without a calculated risk. Every decision is associated with two possibilities. One the positive and the other the negative. There may be other situations demanding decisions, such as you are operating a tableting machine and based on a sample of tablets, the speed of the machine has to be altered. Yes, I am taking another level, technical level. You are operating a tableting machine. Based on a sample of tablets, you take a random sample of tablets and based on their weight or disintegration time, you have to alter something with respect to the tableting machine. So whether you alter or not is again a decision which is to be supplemented by technical details and statistical tools. You have the slide 5. You have the option to use one among four methods of assay for a drug product and you have to choose one. So what is this? Four assay methods are available in your pharmaceutical analysis. Four different assay methods are available for the assaying of a drug substance. So are all the four identical? Which one is more accurate? Which one is more precise? That only you have to take. So in addition to the technical data, you have to utilize statistical tools to select one method among four methods of assay. You have to know whether the variation you are observing in the quality, drug content, weight of your emulsion product is the same, less or more as the variation being observed by other manufacturers. Now there is more in this sentence than it is immediately visible to you. You have to know whether the variation you are observing in the quality, drug content, weight of your emulsion product is the same or less or more as the variation being observed by other manufacturers. Variation is a headache in all the pharmaceutical products. So in some products, you don't get much variation. If you are punching tablets or capsules, in all well-established methods, drug content variation is not a problem. But in certain situations, it could become a problem. In newly developing formulations and all that, variation could be a problem. So is the variation you are observing only due to chance or is it due to a real reason? More and more number of times, we will encounter this word chance and real reason. Chance reason is, it is just a random reason. It is something that is happening due to chance. And chance is having certain properties. Whatever is happening due to chance will happen very rarely. Chance does not happen always. Chance happen very rarely. Like yesterday, there was a tie. How often do you see a tie? How often? You very rarely see a tie. And so maybe there are any play reasons and maybe England and India are identical or same and all that. But do you agree that we expect a decision? Do we expect a tie? But a tie has happened and a tie happens very rarely. I am trying to say that chance reason, whatever we are attributing to chance is having certain properties. One property is it comes rarely. It comes rarely. Second property is the positive side cancels the negative side. The positive side cancels the negative side. So you can think of other examples for this. Suppose one person is very, very disciplined. He comes to the class every day at the same time. Exactly. He's very punctual and all that. Suppose for some reason on one day he is late. So that you attribute to chance. And that side, the positive side will cancel the negative side also. So, but some people are habitually late. So, that is a real reason. That is not a chance reason. That which is happening every day is not due to chance. So, two characteristics are there for chance and real. Chance, whatever you are attributing to chance, whatever variation you are attributing due to chance has two characteristics. One is, it is happening rarely. Second thing is, it is happening on the positive as well as the negative side. Whatever is happening due to a real reason is happening more frequently than the chance. And it is happening usually on only one side. It is not happening on both sides. Either on the plus side or on the minus side. Now the same argument that I have given is just made inverted to come to decisions in the statistical hypothesis. What did I say? Whatever is happening due to chance is having two characteristics. First one is what? It is rare, right? So that argument we invert and we take the decision like this. When something rare has happened, we say it is due to chance. Understand? Understand? So when do we call it as rare? In the normal distribution, something outside the 3 sigma limits. Outside the 3 sigma limits is supposed to be due to chance. It is supposed to be rare and that we attribute to chance. So, these two statements are very important that I am making. Please think about them later on also, which will help you understand how the decision making process. So, when we are finally making a comparison of different treatments, when we are finding out the variation, comparing the variation, if something is very rare, we say it is only due to chance. It is not due to a real reason. So, basically then we are observing, is it happening frequently? Is it happening rarely? If it is frequently, real reason. Rarely, chance reason. So, you have to know whether the variation you are observing in the quality, drug content, weight of your product is same or less or as the variation being observed by other manufacturers. Slide number 6. Here I am trying to introduce some definitions to you. Whatever chapter we are studying, definitions come first. So, what is the probability? Like this, whatever may be your field of work, decisions may have to be taken and you are often in a situation where you have to use the principles of statistical inference. what are the principles of statistical inference? You find out your mean value, you find out the mean value of the population. Then the difference between the means becomes the numerator, and standard error involving the sigma and the n becomes the denominator. Then making use of these, you take a decision. Comparing your mean value with the mean value of the population and make utilizing the standard error also, when you determine a statistic and using that you take a decision, that is statistical inference for you. What we are doing is we are applying the probability theory to our problems. This theory can help us in solving problems in behavioral, natural, social, medical and pharmaceutical sciences. So we are applying probability in estimation or in inference. What we are doing, we are applying probability. Just now I said, if something is outside 3 sigma limits, it is due to a rare thing, chance. So it is a very difficult thing, that is outside expectations. So according to probability, that probability is the based upon the normal distribution. The normal distribution is having certain properties. Within 1 sigma limits, it is having 68.34%. Within x bar plus or minus 1 sigma, is having 68.34% values. Within 2 sigma limits, it is having 95% values. Within 3 sigma limits, it is having 99% values. Let me explain that concept to you, because that is central to the understanding of statistical inference. Let us just again imagine there are 100 students in this class. 100 students in this class. I conduct a test and I find out that the mean value is 60. Mean value is 60. I find out that the standard deviation is 5. Then I do what? I write down all the marks. 100 marks I write down. Then it is very probable. It is very probable that within 55 to 65, within that limit, 68 number of students are there. 68 number of students' marks are falling within 55 to 65. Then within 50 to 70, 95 students' marks are falling. Within 45 to 75, 99 students' marks are falling. Only one student is outside the limits. This is the expectation based on the probability theory, because the marks of all the students follow usually a normal distribution. So, two points are involved here. One thing is that the likelihood of my whatever I have told just now becoming true increases with the number of students to whom we are considering. Suppose the number is not 100, suppose the number is 200, my point becomes more valid, more truer. So this is known as the inertia of large numbers. The whatever theories that we are propounding become truer and truer if you are considering larger and larger numbers. The larger the sample size is, the truer our statements are. This is what I am talking about. This is what we are considering when we are taking the thing. So this is the basis of our later on arguments. So based on this theory, we are taking our decisions. So the variability in the data is again depending upon how much variability is there. Depending upon the situation, variability is there. So we are testing in the Z test and the T test, we are comparing the means. In the F test, we are comparing the variabilities. So it slide 7, we are seeing this. It provides an important tool for the analysis of any situation which in some way involves an element of uncertainty or chance. Probability theory is the basis for our methods which we use when we generalize from observed data. These methods are methods of statistical inference. Here again, see the point which I have underlined. When we use generalize from observed data, so one way is, suppose I say there is somebody sitting in the in our lounge. He is extremely fair in complexion. From which country he might have come? What is your answer? Extremely fair? Yes? USA. Okay, you are talking about India? European country, right? So, what is it that you have done? From a sample, you have generalized to the... No. What you have done is, you have a knowledge of the European countries. People are fair. So, you are saying from your general knowledge, you are talking about this person. You have not seen that person. I said somebody is sitting there, he is extremely fair, and you have concluded he is from the European countries. You are right. So, from a knowledge, generalized knowledge, you are coming to the sample and you are making the conclusion. This is one variety of science. Yes, that is inference for you. Then, the... So, you take a sample of, here are some 10 extremely intelligent engineering graduates. From which place they might have graduated? IIT. See, from the sample you are talking about. So, again, maybe I have given the same type of example, but two varieties are there. Anyway, studying a sample and conclusion, no, I will give you a sample. So, some 5 students come, they are behaving very well, they are very disciplined and all that. So, we ask them, from which college you have come? Say, suppose they say, we have come from Andhra University. Then, what do we say? Okay, Andhra University is a place where good students are coming from. See, that is going from the sample to the back. So, in one case, you have a knowledge of the general situation from which you are concluding about the sample. In the second situation, you are studying the sample and from there you are going to a conclusion with respect to the general. So, these two are the different varieties. Both are inferences. That is the way we are inferencing using the statistical inference. Yes. Again, we are in for some definitions. Before we go for the methods in slide 8. In slide 8, what do we see? Before we go for the methods, we must understand the terminology. Statistical data are the raw material of our investigations. These data may be measured on 4 varieties of scales. The nominal scale, the ordinal scale, the interval data, and the ratio data. In slide 9, I have defined what nominal data is. This is the most basic variety of scale. If the data can be divided into 2 or more categories based on qualitative differences and there is no gradation, like one is more, higher or nicer than the other, then the data are nominal data. Example, a class of students is divided into boys and girls. 2, the drug products available are divided into tablets and capsules. So, it is a very simple scale. It is not often used in pharmaceutical sciences. It is a scale used in social variety of studies or even otherwise newspapers and all those things. Who are studying in general may be using this scale. Experimenters, like in pharmaceutical sciences, we are not much using the nominal scale. It merely divides the data into 2 classes without one class being more, another class being less. It might be boys and girls or tablets and capsules, or it might be like those who like coffee, those who like tea. So, such is a nominal scale. The next important scale is shown in slide 10. Ordinal data. When the data are divided into categories and the categories are arranged one above the other, we say that the data is an ordinal data. Example, bags of lactose obtained from different suppliers are categorized as excellent, good, average and poor. Materials used in construction are categorized as strong, average, weak, etc. So, the ordinal data scale is a step above the nominal data scale. It is a higher scale than the nominal scale. So, in the ordinal data scale, what we are doing? We are categorizing into different categories and we are placing one category above the other. Like, suppose a company is using lactose and it bought lactose from a number of companies. So, all these bags are classified as excellent, good, average and poor. So, that's a ordinal variety of scale. Or materials used in construction are categorized as strong, average, weak, and week. Or I may ask all of you, how frequently are you going to the library? Please raise hands. How many people are going very frequently? Not one. Frequently. We'll include the department library also for your benefit. Not only central library. Only one? Occasionally? Okay. Rarely? That means all of you. Okay. Right. So it is okay for our definition of the ordinal data. Very frequently, and occasionally, rarely. But as a teacher, I don't welcome that. This is a golden period for you in which you are staying in the university. You must make use of the university facilities and go to the library more often. That is a treasure trove. In our days, I am not able to stop myself from saying this. 4 o'clock, our class, 4:10, our classes used to end, especially in B form. 4:20, all of us are in the library, central library, not department library. All of us, 22 of us are in the library, and we used to have so many fights because some books are kept by somebody somewhere else and all that. We used to stay till 8 o'clock, till the man used to come and close. He used to push us out of the library and close the doors. I can't say that we have lost anything from that. We have gained a lot. Please, not only subject, there are so many divisions in the central library. Please visit them. Periodical section is there. Research section is there. Textbook section is there. Please go and visit the central library and our department library very frequently. Right? Next time I ask about the ordinal data, I hope to get a different type of picture. Very frequently should be high. Rarely should be low. Slide 11, interval data. If we can arrange the data on a scale which has equal differences or intervals, then we call it interval data. Temperature scale is an example for that. Suppose we have different liquid samples at 1000 degrees centigrade, 800 degrees centigrade, no sorry, 10 degrees, 100 degrees centigrade, 80 degrees centigrade, 60 degrees centigrade and 59 degrees centigrade, then that is the temperature scale. In slide 12, we are continuing. We can say that 100 degrees centigrade is greater than 80 degrees centigrade is greater than 59 degrees centigrade is less than 60 degrees centigrade and 80 degrees centigrade minus 79 degrees centigrade is equal to 60 degrees centigrade minus 59 degrees centigrade. But we cannot say that 80 degrees centigrade water is twice as hot as 40 degrees centigrade. Let me explain what I am trying to say in this slide. In the slides 11 and 12. An interval scale is so made that the distance which it is covering in every interval, the same distance is covered. Between every unit, the same number of gradations are there. 59 to 60 minus 59 is equal to 1 degree centigrade. So also 80 minus 79 is also equal to 1 degree centigrade. Those intervals are same. That's all that you can say. But you cannot say that 80 degree centigrade, imagine there are two beakers of water on this table. 80 degree centigrade, 40 degree centigrade. Put your right hand in 80 degree centigrade water, left hand in 40 degree centigrade water. Can you say that right hand is feeling twice as much heat as the left hand? You cannot, because that ratio is not there between these two. That is because the zero is not a real zero. The zero of the temperature scale is not a real zero. Whereas the zero of a weight scale is zero, the zero of a height scale is zero. If a small child of 1 foot height is coming here, you record the height is 1 foot. Another child of 2 feet height is coming, 2 feet high. The 2 feet boy is twice as tall as a 1 foot boy. Agreed? That is right. That is because zero means there is nothing. Zero means there is no height. Similarly, weight. 10 kg boy, 20 kg boy. 20 kg boy is twice as heavy as the 10 kg boy. That is there because 0 means there is no weight on the scale. Now come to the temperature scale. I am saying you can't say that 80 degrees is not twice as hot as 40 degrees. That is because if the water is at 0 degrees centigrade, can you say that there is no heat in it? Can you say that there is no energy in it? That is not true. That is not true. Because heat energy is defined as mass into specific heat into delta T. So the mass and specific heat are there. The delta T is also there. Suppose I have 0 degree centigrade ice. 0 degree centigrade means ice is forming. Imagine a cabin in which 0 degree centigrade ice is there and something you keep there which is at minus 10 degree centigrade. Then heat will flow from the ice to the minus 10 degree centigrade. That means heat is there in that or not? Yes. So, because in the temperature scale, 0 degrees is not real. This is not a ratio scale, this is an interval scale. Further one point I will tell and we will move on. Observe that the height scale and the weight scale are real scales, whereas the temperature scale is a scale defined by the scientist for the measurement of the internal energy of the compounds. The temperature scale and the pH scale are defined by the scientists. So they are different scales from the height and the weight scales, which are actually real scales. There is a difference between them. So this is an interval scale. This problem arises, slide 13. This problem arises because the centigrade temperature scale has an artificial zero. If the temperature of a substance in 0 degrees centigrade, if it does not indicate the absence of heat, which the temperature scale is trying to measure. Understand? Though it is saying zero, it does not mean the absence of heat. Heat is a form of energy and energy is there in the substance even though the temperature scale is showing zero. That is the reason why this scale is not a true scale like a height and the weight scale. Did you understand? Understand? Yes. Slide 14, ratio scale. If we can also form quotients with the data, we call it ratio data. If we can also form quotients with the data, we call it ratio data. If a boy is 2 feet tall and if another boy is 4 feet tall, we can say that the second boy is twice as tall as the first boy. Yes or no? Yes. Unlike 80 degree centigrade water and 40 degree centigrade water, we can clearly say that boy is twice as tall as this boy. Measurements of length, height, money amounts. 40 rupees is twice as much as 20 rupees. No problem with understanding that, yes? Because zero means zero. Zero means there is nothing in the pocket. Money amounts, weight, volume, area, pressure, elapsed time, sound intensity, density, brightness, velocity are all ratio scale measurements. These are basic concepts in statistics for you. This is like ABCD in statistics. It is very, very important that you get the concepts of all the four scales. Nominal, ordinal, interval, ratio. So in pharmaceutical sciences, we are always using interval scale and ratio scale. 95% of the time we are using ratio scale and interval scale. Very rarely we are using the nominal or the ordinal data because decisions based on interval scale and ratio scale are more valid, are carrying more weight than decisions taken on the basis of the first two scales. The first two scales are merely basic scales, and when a decision is based on those two scales, it is not having any much weight. So when your decisions are based on the last two varieties of scales, then only your decisions are much valid. So your experimentation in your research should be focused on generating data which is on interval and ratio scales. Let us see a few more decisions. Slide 15. Population. The large unit or space or gathering that is under study is called a population. If a set of data consists of all conceivably possible or hypothetically possible observations of a certain phenomenon, we call it a population. If a set of data contains only a part of these observations, we call it a sample. We call it a sample. So, I think it is, the concept is clear, but anyway, we'll talk about it. The population is the large whole. The sample is the small subunit of the population. The sample is a subset of the population. So, the population usually, if a set of data consists of all conceivably possible, that is whatever you can think, hypothetically possible, observations of a certain phenomenon, we call it a population. How many runs can a batsman get in one innings? What is the bottom possible? Zero. Duck. Starting from? What is the maximum possible? Go on, think. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you can go on writing all of them. So, you can write 0, 2. What is the best score so far? Double century. Okay, you are talking about one day. Now, what is the biggest score? Whose name is it? Clive Lloyd? Brian Lara. How much? 400, that's all? Or more than 400? So, that's in a test match. Okay, we are talking about a test match. 0 to but 400, but somebody will come and beat Brian Lara someday because records are kept to be broken. So, imagine further, okay, 600 are conceivably possible. So, you keep whatever is hypothetically possible, 400, 500, 600, okay, 600. So, that is the population for you. What is a sample? You take a few batsmen who have played in the last 5 test matches. What are the scores? You write down, that is a sample for you. So, the population is containing, sometimes the population is definite. Suppose you go to a medical shop and you take all the formulations that are there. That is your population. So, it is having maybe 500 numbers, maybe 600 numbers, maybe 1000 numbers. That is a clear population for you. There is nothing hypothetical about it. But what are the possible scores of all the batsmen is a hypothetical. Because today it is 400, tomorrow it may be 401 may be there, 420 may be there. So, that is a hypothetical population for you. When you take the runs scored by a few batsmen, that is a sample for you. So, the sample is a subset of a population. A population may be real. Slide 16. A population may be real. We may be wishing to study the quality of empty large volume parenteral bottles, 1 lakh bottles. Then our population is the 1 lakh empty bottles. Suppose in a neighboring room, we keep all the bottles of a particular company. Suppose, I don't say room, neighboring building, 1 lakh bottles are there. We want to study the quality of the empty large volume parenteral bottles. So, 1 lakh is our population. Now, this is a clear population. This is a definite population. Unlike the hypothetical population of the runs scored in a match. So, to do this study, we may pick 30 bottles at random and study them. Then our sample size is 30. To study 1 lakh bottles, we may pick at random 30 bottles. So, 30 is our sample, 1 lakh is the population. A population may be imaginary. Suppose we are punching tablets and we are measuring the hardness of these tablets. Then all the possible values that the hardness may take constitute an imaginary population. Just like now I said runs. So, as the tablet is punching out, suppose we say, this is another situation. Suppose we say, all the tablets that are coming out from this machine form our population. So, as the tablet is coming, it is becoming a part of our population. Many tablets may come. When they come, then they become a part of our population. It is not a definite population. Like suppose I say, all the students in this class are my population. It is a definite population. But when I say all the tablets coming from this machine are my population, so as the tablets are coming, they become a part of my population. Suppose I say the hardnesses of all these tablets I am studying, then the hardness values, as they come, they become, this is a hypothetical type of population. Slide 17, sample. A sample is a small subunit or a fraction of the large unit called population that we are studying. It's a subunit or a subset of the population. We study the sample and based on our studies, we make conclusion regarding the population. This is what I am talking about. What is the use of a sample? A sample is a subset of the population. We study the sample and based on the sample, we take decision with respect to the population. From 1 lakh glass bottles, we may pick up 30 bottles at random and study them for their quality. Slide 18. Based on our observations of these 30 bottles, we form judgments regarding the entire 1 lakh bottles. Like I said, we study 5 students who have come from Andhra University, and from that we take a decision regarding Andhra University. To distinguish between description of populations and description of samples, we use different words and symbols. When we talk about population characteristics, we use the word parameter, and when we talk about sample characteristics, we use the word statistic. So parameter, when we use the word parameter for the population, for the parameter means we are talking about population. Statistic means we are talking about the sample. For the mean, we use the symbol mu when we talk about the population. We use the symbol x bar when we are talking about the sample. Then we use, for standard deviation, we use sigma when we are talking about the population, and s when we are talking about the sample. And for sample size, we use small n we are talking about the sample, and capital N when we are talking about the population. 19. Population parameters are denoted by Greek letters such as mu for mean and sigma for standard deviation. Sample statistics are denoted by English letters such as x bar for mean and s for standard deviation. Slide 20. Sampling distribution. This is another important concept, very much a key element in the statistical inference. What is a sampling distribution? If we take several samples from a large population, determine a statistic such as mean, x bar for all those samples, and form a frequency distribution with those mean values, then such a distribution is known as the sampling distribution, and its standard deviation is known as the standard error of the mean. 21. For random samples of size n taken from a population having the mean and the standard deviation sigma, the theoretical sampling distribution of x bar as the mean mu x bar is equal to mu, and the standard deviation is sigma x bar is equal to sigma by square root n, or sigma x bar is equal to sigma by square root n into square root of capital N minus small n divided by capital N minus 1, depending on whether the population is infinite or finite of size n. It is a standard error of the mean. The standard error, slide 22, the standard error sigma by square root n plays a very fundamental role in our statistical inference. It measures the extent to which sample means can be expected to fluctuate or vary due to chance. Let me explain the concept of sampling distribution and standard error, because they are central to statistical inference. You look at this last sentence in slide 22. Standard error plays a very fundamental role in our statistical inference. It measures the extent to which sample means can be expected to fluctuate or vary due to chance. This last sentence is very important. When we are comparing the means, when we are trying to find out whether the difference observed between the means is merely due to chance or due to a real reason, we can tell with the help of the standard error. The standard error is telling us whether it is due to chance or due to the real reason. Let us understand the concept of sampling distribution and the standard error. Just imagine that Andhra University is having 10,000 students. The vice chancellor calls 100 teachers like me, and he gives an assignment to all of us 100 teachers. Each one of you, you take a random sample of 100 students from the 10,000 students and determine their height and give me the mean and the standard deviation. So what is my job? My job as one of the teachers is, I must take a random sample of 100 students. I should not make all of you M-Farm students sit in the class and determine your height. No. I must consider the 10,000 students in Andhra University, and I must take a random sample of the 10,100 by using random number tables, and for the 100 randomly chosen students, I must determine the height. Then I have 100 numbers For those 100 numbers, I must calculate the mean value and the standard deviation value. Then I must meet the vice chancellor and give him the mean and the standard deviation. Then my job is over. Now the vice chancellor is having 100 mean values with him. So many numbers, he is unable to take any decision and 100 standard deviations. Then he will call his officer and tell him, please make a frequency distribution of these 100 values. So the 100 values may be ranging from say 130 centimeters to 180 centimeters. They may be varying between these two. So they will form a class interval. They will form a frequency distribution. First column class interval 130 to 135, 135 to 140, 140 to 145. Like that they will form a class interval. Second column they will put the tally marks. As a number comes, they will put a tally mark. Third column is the frequency. Making use of the class interval and the frequency, they will determine the mean value. So, please observe that all these 100 are what values? They are mean values. Remember, each teacher has taken 100 values and determined the mean values. So, the 100 mean values formed a sampling distribution. So, that is the sampling distribution. A distribution of the statistics is the sampling distribution. So, the mean of them is known as the grand mean. For these 100 values, whatever you are mean that you are determining is the mean of the means. So, it is the grand mean. For that, when you determine the standard deviation, sigma, that is the standard error. So, what is the standard error? The standard error is the standard deviation of the sampling distribution. What is the sampling distribution? When from a large population, you are taking a number of samples. For each sample, you are calculating a mean and the standard deviation. And for each mean, all the means, you are forming a distribution. The mean of the distribution is the grand mean. The standard deviation of the distribution is the standard error. You can repeat this process with the standard deviations also. You can form a frequency distribution of the standard deviations, determine the mean standard deviation, determine the standard error. There also it is known as the standard error. Did you get the concept of standard error? What is the purpose of standard error? Standard error forms the denominator in the test. The difference in the means divided by the standard error is giving you a ratio value. That ratio, if it is very less, we accept the null hypothesis. That ratio, if it is more, we reject the null hypothesis. So, this is the sampling distribution I am repeating. When there is a large population, from that we take a number of samples, and for those samples we determine the mean value. Then with all those mean values we form a frequency distribution. That frequency distribution is known as the sampling distribution. For that, when we calculate the mean, it is known as the grand mean. For that, when we determine the standard deviation, we call it as the standard error. This is the concept. In the actual problem where you are working out, you are not doing all these things. If you have to determine the standard error, you have to do sigma by square root n, where sigma is the standard deviation, n is the sample size. Number 23, standard error. The smaller the standard error, the less the means are spread out, and the better are our chances that the estimate will be close. The standard error of the mean increases as the variability of the population increases, and it decreases as the sample size increases. Standard error is a very important parameter. Standard error is more means, the ratio will become less. So, the standard error of the mean increases as the variability of the population increases, and it decreases as the sample size increases. So, it is indicating the variation. Sigma by square root n. If standard deviation is more, that means what? Variability is more. So, standard error increases as the variability is increasing. Standard error is decreasing as the variability is decreasing. What about sample size? It is in the denominator. Sigma by square root n. N is in the denominator. If n increases, standard error is decreasing. If n decreases, standard error is increasing. Slide 24, testing of hypothesis. Again, let us consider an imaginary situation. You have prepared two different drug products, a tablet and a capsule for a particular drug. You want to determine whether one product is superior to another. So you take a sample of 10 tablets and find their effect on 10 rats. So here you are doing an experiment. You have prepared in your M.Pharm work a tablet and a capsule for the same drug. You want to find out whether the tablet is more effective or the capsule is more effective. Whose bioavailability is more? So you want to determine whether one product is superior to another. For that, what do you take? You take a sample of 10 tablets and find their effect on 10 rats. You administer to 10 rats and find out. For 10 rats, you give the tablet. For 10 rats, you give the capsule. Okay, I have slide 25. I am talking about a crossover study, not a parallel study. So, what you are doing? For the 10 rats, first you give the tablet. 1 week later, you give the capsule and find out the bioavailability. 1 week later, you take a sample of 10 capsules and find their effect, bioavailability on the same 10 rats. If you are measuring the bioavailability in terms of area under the curve, and if the difference observed is 20, next you are faced with the question, is this 20 significant? Can we, on the basis of this difference, declare that one drug product is superior to another? Is this difference due to a real reason? Is the quality of drug product superior? Slide 26. Is this merely due to chance reason? Due to chance reasons such as small errors that may creep into the experimental procedure unexpectedly? Or is it due to a real reason? A real reason is a reason which is due to a built-in difference or variability in the drug product. So, you are testing the tablet on 10 rats. 1 week later, you are administering capsules to the same 10 rats and you are finding the difference. Suppose it comes out that the capsule is having more bioavailability. When we are talking about bioavailability, suppose we are determining area under the curve. Suppose the area under the curve given for that capsules is coming out to be more by 20. Now you are faced with the decision. Do you conclude that capsules are better than the tablets? Or do you conclude that, no, this 20 is only due to some chance reason, such as some experimental error that might have kept in. Maybe we have measured something wrong. Is it due to experimental error? Is it due to variability between tablet and capsule? That is your decision. 27. A chance reason has no basis and happens unexpectedly. However, systematic we are, we cannot completely replicate the conditions of an experiment and some small stray or chance errors will creep in. However, the effect of the real reason is considerable and the effect of the chance reason is much smaller than the effect of the real reason. Here I am again talking about chance reason and real reason because they are central to the understanding of inference. This again I will talk about when I talk about ANOVA. Every result that you are having, please understand the result that I am talking about. What do I mean by result? Let us suppose the area under the curve you have obtained in a particular experiment is the result. This area under the curve is representing the bioavailability that has come because of the tablet. Now, this area under the curve that you have got is having two components. One component is because of the real reason, that is the effect of the medicine which is there in the tablet is giving. There may be some error component. That error may be due to chance. So, experiments are full of errors. Here there is one more point that you have to understand. You are doing so many experiments, you have done so many in your B-Pharm, you are doing now. In some of the experiments, suppose you are doing a dissolution study. What you are doing? You are taking a tablet, you are starting the dissolution equipment. Then suppose it is paddle method, you take a basket, a glass basket, you put some 0.1 HCl in it, you put the paddle, you put the tablet, you arrange for the temperature and you run at so many RPM per hour and periodically you are taking the samples. So this study is known as an in vitro study. So whatever I told just now, this experiment, If you repeat 3 times, periodically you are taking a sample, you are filtering the sample, that sample you are keeping in the UV spectrophotometer and you are finding the absorbance. From the absorbance, from the standard graph, you are finding what is the amount of drug in the solution. This is the dissolution study. So suppose you repeat 3 times, suppose you are finding the percent drug dissolved, it is very likely that you will get very near values. Suppose at 10 minutes, it is giving 10 mg, 10% drug dissolved. It is likely that in the 3 replications, you will get 10, 10.5, 9.8, like that. Very near you will get. It is also likely that you get 10, 10.1, 9.9, like that. The variability will be very less in vitro experiments. And there your skill is there. Somebody who is working with good skill, with good precision, will get good values. Somebody who is not so exact may get some poor values. But in general, in vitro experiments are very reproducible. Variability is very less. Did you understand that, what I told? Now, compare that with this experiment. You take the same 3 tablets, administer them to 3 rats, take the blood samples and find out the area under the curve. It is likely that there is a lot of variability. What I am trying to make you understand is that biological variability is quite a lot. This is known as an in vivo experimentation. And in vivo experimentation, we expect a lot of variability. All data on human beings or animals, biological values are all having a lot of variability. It is this variability that makes our decisions difficult. It is this variability that makes experimental design very important to us. So come back to the chance reason. So in vitro as well as in vivo, the result has 2 components. A huge part of it is due to the real reason. A small part of it is due to the chance reason. Now the job before us will be to understand the variability. Is it due to chance or is it due to a real reason? So however systematic we are, we cannot totally replicate. Some error will be there. So, 28. Testing of hypothesis. In testing of hypothesis, we are testing to see if the difference observed between 2 statistic values, 2 means or 2 variances is merely due to chance, in which case we declare it as not significant, or due to a real reason, in which case we declare it as significant. So, in what is that we are doing in testing of hypothesis? We compare 2 means. And if the difference is small, we say that it is due to a chance reason. If the difference is large, we say that it is due to variation. Rather than taking the difference, what we take, we determine a ratio. We take the difference that we have come in the numerator, that we have got in the numerator, and in the denominator, the standard error is signifying the difference that might come due to the variability. So in the denominator, we are taking 1 component. In the numerator, we are taking 1 component. We are determining the ratio. If the ratio is larger than what is shown in the tables, what are the tables showing? That ratio which might come due to chance they are showing. If the ratio which we have got is more than what is shown in the tables, we reject the null hypothesis. Otherwise, we accept. Did you get that concept? I am repeating. We are determining a ratio. For that ratio, for all tests, this is common, whether you are determining Z or T or whatever it is. In the numerator, we are taking the difference that we have got. In the denominator, we are taking the standard error. What the standard error is, we have already studied. So, what should be this ratio? If it is only due to chance, is given in the statistical tables. If our ratio, which we have calculated in our problem, is more than what is shown in the table, we reject the null hypothesis. If it is less than what is shown in the tables, we accept the null hypothesis. Slide 28. In testing of hypothesis, we are testing to see if the difference observed between 2 statistic values is merely due to chance, in which case we declare it as not significant. or due to a real reason, in which case we declare it as significant. 29. In the first case, the ratios of the difference between the means by the standard error of the mean is smaller than the ratio expected due to chance given in the tables. In the second case, this ratio is larger than the ratio expected due to chance. 30. This is the classical table. In making this decision, we stand the risk of making two types of errors. In the introduction to this class, I told you, every decision has two sides. It may be right, it may be wrong. So, then, for every situation, there are two decisions. Each decision has two components. So, there are four types of situations. So, based on the sample, so what did I say? For every sample, we take a ratio with the difference between the means in the numerator with the standard error in the denominator. Suppose the ratio comes out to be more than the table value, we reject. Suppose the ratio comes out to be less than the table value, we accept. So, we have decided here, we have kept here a situation. H0 is the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis is a statement of no difference. We say that there is no difference between A and B. There is no difference between diclofenac and ibuprofen. Or we write like this, the difference observed between diclofenac and ibuprofen is only due to chance. It is not due to a real reason. That is the null hypothesis. So, we have written decision from the sample, maybe two decisions. We may reject H0, we may accept H0. Here, vertically we have written H0 may be true, H0 may be false. If H0 is false, H1 may be true. What is H1? H1 is the alternative hypothesis. If H0 says there is no difference between the means, H1 says there is difference between the means. Four possibilities are there. Look at the first one. H0 is true and we reject. That is wrong. If H0 is true, that means there is no difference between the means, but we reject it and we assume a difference. So, that is wrong. H0 is true. That is, there is no difference between the means and we accept it. That is, when there is no difference, we say that we accept it. That is correct. H0 is false. We reject it. That is the correct thing. H0 is false and we accept it. That is wrong. So, type 1 error is in the first case and type 2 error is in the bottom case. So, type 1 error is also called as the alpha error. Type 2 error is also called as the beta error. And 1 minus beta is known as the power of a test. Slide 31, testing of hypothesis. In this testing of hypothesis, we follow a particular procedure. If the null hypothesis of no difference is true and we accept it, it is the correct decision. But if we reject it, we are committing what is called as type 1 error or error of commission. We'll take this in the context of the R&D example that we have taken in the beginning. The R&D officer came to us and asked us, I have a new product, please introduce it into the market. We are taking that sample, that example. So, suppose there is an existing product. We have an existing product A. R&D officer brought a new product B. Now, the null hypothesis is, there is no difference between A and B. A and B are same. There is no difference between A and B. Now, look at this situation. If the null hypothesis of no difference is true, A and B are same, there is no difference. And we accept it. We say that, yes, there is no difference between A and B. It is the correct decision. A and B are the same, there is no difference between A and B. And we declare, there is no difference between A and B. I am not introducing B into the market. That is the correct decision. But if we reject it, we are committing what is called as type 1 error or error of commission. Suppose there is no difference between A and B. But I say, this difference is a lot and if I introduce B into the market, what I am doing? I am committing an error of commission. when there is no difference between A and B, if I put B in the market, nobody will buy B. So, I am doing an error of commission. When there is no difference between A and B, if I assume the difference, whatever small difference is there due to a real reason, and if I think B is a great product, and if I introduce B into the market, that is error of commission. That is type 1 error. So, what is type 1 error? When the difference that is there between A and B is not really much, but whatever is small difference is there, I assume it to be great and I do something, I take action, that is error of commission. Slide 32. If the null hypothesis is false and if we reject it, we are taking the correct decision, but if we accept it, we are committing what is called as type 2 error or error of omission. Listen. If the null hypothesis is false, null hypothesis is false means what? The difference is significant. The difference is significant. A and B are different from each other. And if we reject it, we say the null hypothesis is saying there is no difference. So we reject it. Difference is significant. And then we are correct. When the difference is significant, we say we reject the null hypothesis and we introduce B into the market. If we take the correct decision, but we accept it, we are committing what is called as type 2 error or error of omission. So, what is the point here? A and B are having some difference. The difference we are saying is that it is actually too much. We should introduce into the market, but we say, no, no, this difference is not much and I don't put B into the market. That is error of omission. Type 2 error. You can remember type 2 error like this. You see, that test is supposed to be good, which can detect a difference that is there. If a test fails to detect a difference, that is not a good test. That test is a good test. That test is having power of a test, which is capable of detecting a difference that is there. If there is a lot of difference, but the test is unable to recognize the difference and rejects the and accepts the null hypothesis and omits to take action, that is an error of omission. What is type 2 error? Type 2 error is the error of omission, or it is the error of failing to see a difference that is there. What is type 1 error? Type 1 error is overimagining the difference that is there. Type 2 error is the error of failing to see a difference that is there. So, type 2 error is the error of omission. Taking again our example of introducing a new formulation into the market, the test and the analysis go like this. The R&D chief proposes to introduce a new formulation NF into the market. Slide 33. The R&D chief says that it is much better than the old formulation OF. Old formulation is OF, new formulation is NF. We take 100 units of NF and study some property such as bioavailability from these units in rats. Let us say the result is 150. 1 week later, we take 100 units of old formulation and study the same property in the same manner on the same rats and the result is 120. So, what is the difference? 30 is the difference. The difference observed is 30. Is this difference significant or not? So, to determine whether this difference between the old formulation and the new formulation is it significant or not, we follow the testing of hypothesis. We follow the testing procedure. 34. Case 1. Suppose at 0.05 level of significance, the test statistic is more than the table value. What is the test statistic? We have not so far done, but we will do it by t-test. What is the size of the sample? Then what is the test? Z. Z is the test. By Z, Z becomes the test statistic. At 0.05 level of significance, it is more than the table value. We reject the null hypothesis and declare the difference to be significant. Some difference is there. We say that the difference is significant and we reject H naught, then we introduce a new formulation into the market. 35. Suppose the experiment we did on a few rats with a few tablets or capsules is really indicative of the real nature of the difference, then the people will find a real increase in bioavailability with our product. Our NF will be a hit and we will get profits and fame. Our decision here is proved correct. Did you follow the logic? We have taken 100 rats. We have administered to 100 rats. We found the difference to be 150 minus 120, 30. We said that this 30 is significant and we introduced the new formulation into the market. Whatever we have found on a sample basis on rats has translated into a real effect on human beings. And the people like our product, we get profits and we get money. Our decision is correct. 36. But suppose our experiment is not a true indicator of the real situation. Please try to grasp what I am saying there. We have tested on 100 rats. Whatever result we have got on 100 rats is not indicative of the real picture. And suppose there is really not that much difference between the OF and the NF practically, then people will reject our NF. It will become a flop. We lose money and prestige. Are you getting the picture? All data are same. Decision is also same. Outcome is different. In the first outcome, our decision is right. People accepted. We got money and fame. In the second, outcome is different. People, whatever we have got on the sample basis has not translated into a real picture. People rejected our formulation and we lose money and prestige. Here, what is the error we are committing? Type 1 error, rejecting a true H0. When we should not have taken any action, we are taking action. This is known as error of commission. It is important to get all these concepts as well as words. When H0 is right, that is, there is no difference. We have rejected it and we have assumed that there is a difference when it is not there. That is type 1 error. As a result of this error, what we have taken? Whereas we should not have taken any action, we have introduced the product into the market. As a result, what has happened? We lost prestige, we lost profits. So this is error of commission. When we should have kept quiet, we have taken action. This is error of commission. 37. Case 2. Suppose at 0.05 level of significance, the test statistic is less than the table value. We accept the null hypothesis and declare the difference to be not significant. Result is same, that 30 only. But suppose the test statistic has come out as less than the table value. And what do? We declare the difference to be not significant. We accept the null hypothesis. Then we do not introduce the NF into the market. NF goes to a rival manufacturer and he introduces into the market. So what we have done, the difference between NF and OF, we say it is not significant. We accept the null hypothesis. We keep quiet. We don't introduce NF into the market. 38. If our decision is right and there is really no difference between the OF and NF, then we save a lot of money and time. And the rival manufacturer who introduced it into the market loses money, time and prestige as well. Understand? So we have not done any action. Our NF has gone to a rival manufacturer. He introduced into the market. What happened to us? We have not lost anything. We have not lost any money. We have not lost any prestige. The rival who introduced lost money and prestige. So that is good for us. But if our decision is wrong and the NF becomes a hit, then the rival manufacturer gets profit and fame and we are shown to be cowards. We lose face. 39. Where we should have taken action, we hesitated and stayed back. This is known as error of omission or type 2 error. Please understand this. So, when there is a difference, we fail to recognize the difference. When the NF is superior to OF, we fail to get the difference. We fail to take action where we should have taken action. This is type 2 error and error of omission. So, decision taking involves thinking on these terms, balancing the two errors, deciding which error is more serious to us and taking the calculated risk. So, this is the most important sentence maybe in my lecture. So, every decision involves thinking on these terms, balancing the two errors, deciding which error is more serious to us, and taking a calculated risk. Every decision has two outcomes. So one outcome is a safe, one outcome is risky. So balancing the two errors and taking a decision is important. We have to take a calculated risk, otherwise we are shown to be cowards. There is no decision which is absolutely correct and error free. There are no rules which tell us which error should be minimized. There are no rules for that which tell us to be minimized. 40. Power of a test. But that test which can detect a difference that exists is known to be more powerful. As scientists, you understand this. Suppose I have to take a preference between type 1 error and type 2 error. I would prefer an error of commission rather than an error of omission. That is, I would prefer to introduce NF into the market and take the calculated risk. That is, I will try to adopt an attitude where if there is a difference, I would like to acknowledge it rather than ignore a difference that is there. Understand that? So, the power of a test is recognized like this. Probability of committing type 1 error is called alpha, and the probability of committing type 2 error is called as beta. 1 minus beta is known as the power of a test. Among the two errors, usually error of omission, failure to see a difference which is there, is considered more serious, and a test in which this error is less is a more powerful test. This slide is a very important slide. Please understand this. When you are taking a decision, always there is a plus side and there is a negative side. In every situation, there are two decisions, and every decision may have two outcomes. So, that decision which involves recognizing a difference which is there is a good decision. That decision which is reducing the type 2 error, 1 minus beta, alpha is the type 1 error, beta is the type 2 error, and 1 minus beta is known as the power of a test. So always you are faced with decisions, and take the decision on a rational basis. What is a rational basis? Determine the mean value of both alpha and others, old OF and NF, that is the two products involved. Determine the means of the two. Take the difference in the numerator. Take the standard error in the denominator. Determine the ratio. Compare that ratio with the table value. If our ratio is more than the table value, reject. If our ratio is less than the table value, accept. So this is the testing of hypothesis for you. 41. Significance testing. Common parametric tests done in pharmaceutical experiments. Now, tests are divided into two categories, parametric tests and non-parametric tests. Under parametric tests, we talk about jet test, T test, and F test. Among non-parametric, we talk about several tests which are like chi-square, sign test, and all those things. So, it is called as significance testing. What is the significant testing? Is the difference observed between the two means significant or not? That is the question. So, that is the reason why we call it as the significance testing. When we conduct a statistical test to find out whether the difference observed between two statistic values or between a statistic and a parameter is significant or not, it is called as significant testing. To do this, we use some common probability distributions such as Z, T, chi-square, and F. This chi-square sometimes is talked about among parametric, sometimes among non-parametric. But it is mainly a non-parametric test. The Z test, the T test, and the F test are known as parametric tests. The chi-square test comes under non-parametric test, slide 42. Close, Chaitanya? రేపు చూద్దాం. ఓకే, విల్ క్లోజ్. సో టుమారో విల్ సీ ద